Okay, good morning, everybody. Here is Bio 241, and it's February 17th. What does that mean to you? Well, what it means to you is that there is an exam coming up. So let's take a look at your schedule right here. So 17th, 1 week from today, exam number one. All right, and so it's chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. Right, everybody in tune with that? And I think that takes you through week 4 of Blackboard assignments, all those materials. And it's my goal to have all of these modules still available to you until the test. If they disappear for some reason, give me an email, and I'll make sure that you can get to them. Okay, so all the practice questions, online practice questions, you should have access to until that exam. All right, last time we finished up the interaction between cells and their environment. Any questions on that material at all? Questions on that? You're doing pretty good with that? Okay. Well, then I think we should get started, right? So 1 week from today. Oh, I tell you what, before we get started, I do want to tell you one thing, but I'll answer your question first.
Yeah. And it's less negative. I go back and take a look at it. The sodium is a positive charge. So yeah. While they get in the cell, they become less negative.
The inside of the cell becomes less negative, not the sodium ion.
Oh.
Okay, because sodium is a positive ion, and when it goes inside the cell, it brings that positive charge inside the cell, so that helps neutralize the negative charge. It brings it closer to zero.
The six ions.
Yeah, those six ions, right. Right. Okay. Okay. Let's start with our lecture. And I'm going to do this. Yeah. Okay, let's listen to this question, you guys. This sounds like a question I would like a lot. Go ahead. Hey, well, you guys, go step out in the hallway. Really, I'm serious. Go step out in the hallway if you got to finish that conversation, okay? Okay.
When I was thinking of Edna's question,
yeah?
I
Oh, I just didn't hear the beginning of that sentence.
Oh, for example,
yeah?
If one equilibrium is negative 70,
okay.
And another one is negative 90.
Okay. Two different cells?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah?
And then it asks, comparing this to the normal equilibrium, is the change in depolarization or high polarization?
Okay, what would be the normal? 70. Okay, so you want to compare the 70 to the minus 70 to the minus 90? Okay, so I think of a graph. Okay, so we can make a graph of voltage versus time. We're not so interested in time right at the moment. We're really interested with voltage. So this is positive voltage here. So we might just say positive 50, positive 100, okay, 50, 100. Now, what would be the sign of these down over here? Because here's zero, so here is minus and minus, okay? So anytime you move farther in that direction, we call it hyperpolarized. And we haven't talked about this, but I think we're going to be really familiar with it, and so it's great that we're going to look at it right now anyway, hyperpolarized. And if it goes the other way, like that, that's what we call depolarized. Because you're going to be starting, the normal is minus 70, and as you get closer to zero, what happens to the voltage? It goes away. And that's why they call it depolarization. Okay? So I do like that question. If that voltage gets more negative, that's hyperpolarized. If it goes towards zero, that's depolarized. And as a matter of fact, if it even goes positive, we still call that depolarization. Okay? Even though it's moving farther away from zero. Sweet. Good question. Okay. Does that kind of answer your question? I think it's good. Yeah, I always like to see things visually. Then it makes a lot more sense for me. Cell structure and genetic control, chapter 3. A lot of this is review for you guys from anatomy, so that's pretty easy. We're going to talk about protein synthesis. Maybe we didn't talk too much about protein synthesis in anatomy. That's one little difference. All right, so we're looking at a cell. And a cell is the structural and functional unit of life. So if something is alive, what does it have to be made of? It's got to be made of cells. Well, that doesn't really mean anything unless you know what a cell is. What are the components that make up a cell? And here are the three main components. It has to have a cell membrane that separates the outside non-living world with the inside living world. That's a really important component. It has to have cytoplasm. Right, cytoplasm then is everything inside the plasma membrane. And this is where the living processes take place. That's kind of a little nebulous description, right? And then the third thing that a cell has to have, and probably you should cross this off right here. I don't know how that slipped in there. Organelles. It does not have to have organelles, but it has to have genetic material. Say genetic material. And that genetic material for us is in the form of DNA, but some other organisms, that genetic material is in the form of RNA. They can have RNA-like chromosomes. Right, and that genetic material is a way of passing information from one generation to the next. Right, so that's why that genetic material is so important. Right, so the cell can direct the synthesis of other similar kinds of cells in the future because of that genetic information, genetic material. All right, highly organized molecular factory, yeah, indeed, because all of these different organelles right here have different functions. And so I do want you to be able to recognize all of these organelles by their structure, right, by their shape, but also then be able to relate what their function is. Once you see this shape right here, this thing that kind of looks like a bean, I see two membranes involved right here. This is a mitochondria, and I think everybody knows what a job of a mitochondria is, and you could just tell me real quick, what's the job of a mitochondria? Yeah. Some people said produces energy. I like that. And more specifically, that energy is in a readily accessible form, and that is ATP. So that's the job. So mitochondria take in energy in other forms, for instance, like glucose, and convert it into another chemical form of energy, namely ATP, which most things in the cell can take advantage of. All right, so let's look at some of these organelles. As a matter of fact, anybody got a question about how I want you to modify this slide? Plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material, because your book is a little bit sloppy on this, because organelle is really a part of the cytoplasm. All right, so if we want to break, cytoplasm is everything inside the cell membrane. Cytoplasm is made up of two things. One is organelle, and the second is cytosol. That's a more maybe modern way of thinking about cytoplasm, right? Cytoplasm, organelles, and cytosol, which is the fluid part of everything that's dissolved inside the cell. Okay, so don't forget about that genetic material. All right, well, let's start with the plasma membrane. We've looked at it a little bit already. What's the simplest way that we can think of a plasma membrane? I see it on this slide right here. It is the, phospholipid bilayer. We know how it forms because of the physical chemistry of this little phospholipid right here. That's really nice that you have an understanding of that. And you can see that it's in two layers. That's a really nice, easy description. But you see more things going on here than just the phospholipid bilayer. You see all other kinds of components. So a much better way to understand a plasma membrane is in the fluid mosaic model. And the fluid part of that is the phospholipid bilayer. It is very fluid. If we were to put this bilayer on a drop of water and then shake a glass, then the ripples on the top of the glass of water, right, would form, and this plasma membrane would just ride right on top of all those little ripples, right? It would just wave around. It wouldn't fracture, it wouldn't break or anything like that. So it's very fluid. The mosaic part are all of the other things that can be added to the cell membrane, right? A change in structure. So if we change the structure from a simple phospholipid bilayer to a phospholipid bilayer with other kinds of structures, what are we doing to this cell membrane? Yeah, we're definitely changing the function because we're changing the shape, right? We're adding things to it. Well, that phospholipid bilayer is very liquid. It would be best if it was not so liquid. So there is a compound right here. These are cholesterol molecules that kind of adds a little bit of rigidity to the cell membrane. That's the purpose of cholesterol. Just checking to see if I had it on two screens. I do. And why is cholesterol in this part of the phospholipid bilayer? Because the inner part of the membrane is indeed hydrophobic. And what can you tell me about cholesterol? Yeah, it's a lipid, right? So it is hydrophobic as well. So it's very comfortable to be in these locations. Other things we see, right, are proteins. Some proteins go all the way across the membrane. We call these integral proteins because if we take them out of the membrane, we destroy the membrane. Other proteins will be found only on the inside, right? And I don't see any on this diagram, but those are not integral proteins. I can see other branching kinds of molecules. Right? These could be sugar molecules or modified proteins with sugar. Right? So glyco means sugar protein. So here is a part protein. Here's a part sugar molecule. And then here is a glycolipid. Glyco means sugar once again, and lipid just means lipid. So here's a modified lipid that has a sugar molecule attached to it. So what are the functions of all of these things? Well, these proteins that are embedded in the membrane and poke down into the cytoplasm can be attached to other tubes inside the cell, like microtubules. Those microtubules can push and pull on the cell membrane, change the shape of the cell. And there are even some cells that are shapeshifters in our body. Can anybody think, give me the name of a cell that's a shapeshifter, that changes its shape all the time? Yeah, like a, something that crawls around all over, like a macrophage, right? Macrophage. Is a monocyte that has actually crawled out of your circulatory systems, wandering around inside your lungs, looking for things that don't belong there. Okay. Other proteins in the membrane can be channels, and it could be a gated channel or an open channel. And if it's a channel, what will that channel allow to move across the membrane that couldn't ordinarily? Okay, could be water, could be ions. And what are all those things that we've talked about before? Ions and water, how would you classify those things, those substances? What's the physical chemistry? What do all those particles have in common? Okay. It sort of doesn't make a whole lot of sense because we're going to use the answer as part of the definition right here. Because somebody said water, right? And so we would say hydrophilic compounds, right? Any kind of hydrophilic compound can't get across the membrane, so it has to have a different route across the membrane, like a channel or a pore, or maybe it's a gated channel. Maybe it's a channel that opens sometimes, closed at the other, right? So any kind of polar compound or hydrophilic compound needs these channels. There could be transporters, right, that can move all kinds of different materials, which could be hydrophilic or hydrophobic. Some of these proteins can act as enzymes. We haven't talked about enzymes yet. Oh, but that's going to be the next chapter. And the function of an enzyme is to speed up the rate of a chemical reaction. That's what an enzyme does. So there might be some kind of chemical reaction that would take 1,000 years to occur, but in 1,000 years we won't be here any longer, so that wouldn't help us. So an enzyme will speed up that rate to where it might happen almost instantaneously. So those enzymes are very important for living processes, right? And these other kinds of compounds that could be poking out into the extracellular space right here, by their shape, right, we will call these things antigens. So here are molecules that have a certain shape. All the cells in your body have antigens that have the same shape on the outside of the membrane. So if there is, for instance, a macrophage running around looking for foreign material, if it sees that proper shape on the cell membrane, it knows that that cell belongs to you. and is not going to attack it. If it's a different shape, then it knows that cell does not belong to you, and then that cell will be rejected from your body, right? So it's based on the shape of antigens. Your immune system knows, if all goes well, that that cell belongs to you or it does not. All right, so that is the fluid mosaic model, and what some of these proteins can be, transporters, enzymes, identity markers, which we just talked about. Another name for an identity marker would be an antigen. I called it an antigen. What I didn't mention was a receptor, and that is really important. We've been talking a lot about receptors. All right, so if the cell has a receptor to a hormone, then that hormone has the ability to change the physiology inside the cell. And if it doesn't have a receptor for that hormone, then the cell is going to be, will completely ignore that hormone, can't control the cell at all. So those are some things. Okay. These compounds give the outer surface, the surface of this membrane, not the extracellular fluid, but the surface, a little bit of a negative charge to it. Maybe we'll talk about that later on in the class. And then we talked about those surface markers as being antigens. Okay. All right, those proteins in the cell membrane, because they're attached to microtubules, are involved with bulk transport, and that's an active transport mechanism. So, for instance, this could be a really good example of a macrophage, which is a white blood cell. And here is a particle, and can you see a bunch of stuff sticking off the membrane of this particular particle? We could call it a cell. Maybe it's a bacteria, and it's loaded with antigens. This macrophage will know that the cell doesn't belong to you because the shape of those antigens is different than the shape of the antigens that you have on the surface of your cells. And then it will be attacked. The macrophage will surround this particle, bring it on the inside, and will lyse this bacteria. And then it might even carry these antigens to other parts of the immune system so that all parts of the immune system can recognize this infectious little guy right here, this bacteria, right, if all goes well. Well, I think we talked about this stuff already, right? Endocytosis, how would you think about endocytosis? We got two forms of endocytosis. Yeah, cell drinking, cell eating, you should know their proper terms. And they require ATP for that to happen. Exocytosis is the opposite motion of material, so you could think of this as secretion. We're going to look at a secretory pathway in this chapter in just a second. Okay. On the surface of the cell, there are some specializations which are not drawn on the illustration in your textbook, but they are in anatomy books, right? And one is a cilia, another is flagella, and another is microvilli. So if you go all the way back to the picture of this cell at the very beginning, so poking off the surface membrane into the extracellular space will be a very tiny rod sticking up. Some of these tiny rods, right, we're going to call microvilli, some are cilia, some are flagella. So let's talk about what some of these rods do. Okay, cilia. If you're going to think about the function of cilia in just one word, it is motility. So a cell will have hundreds and hundreds of cilia, and they will sweep, they will all beat in one direction. And some cells can actually move around in their environment with cilia, but there are no human cells that move around. But what happens is that the material outside the cell gets pushed by those cilia. So the lining of your trachea, for instance, you all know where your trachea is, are ciliated cells. And those cells are sweeping all the time. There's also goblet cells. What's the function of a goblet cell? Yeah, it makes mucus. So a goblet cell secretes mucus onto that surface of the trachea, and the cilia are sweeping. The mucus will attract dust particles and bacteria. And which way do you think those cilia are sweeping? Down into your lungs or up into your mouth? Yeah, up in your mouth, because we don't want all that stuff blocking up our lungs, right? So all of that garbage gets into our mouth. And then what do? We just swallow it down. Okay? Okay, so cilia is motility for things that are on that apical surface of that membrane. Flagella, a cell, at least our cells, will have one. There's some cells that might have a couple, right? But our cells have one, and again, it's motility. Flagella for that particular cell allows that cell to actually swim around in some kind of environment. So again, that's motility, but it's not moving extracellular material around, it's actually moving the cell around through that fluid environment, and only males produce these kind of cells, and they are called sperm cells, right? Okay. All right. The egg from a female does move, right? And it moves because the fallopian tube and the fimbria is ciliated. All right, so an egg from a woman gets trapped in that flow of material from the fimbria down the fallopian tube to the uterus. All right, so again, we like to think of cilia as motility. Microvilli, on the other hand, are much smaller than cilia, right? And a flagella is much larger than cilia. So if we're going to rank these in terms of size, flagella is the largest, then cilia is the next smallest, and then even the smallest are these microvilli. These are really tiny, super tiny folds on the surface of a cell, and what that does is that it increases the length of a cell in those two dimensions, and that helps in absorption. All right, so that is just makes the membrane that things will move across, and as the cell surface gets larger, then it's easier for a cell to take in material from the outside. So we're going to say microvilli absorption or membrane transport. So here are some cilia that are poking off the surface of these cells right here, and they're sweeping. They're loaded with microtubules. And if you ever think of a microtubule, again, you should think of motility, even inside the cell. These microtubules allow for like a rapid transport system, a monorail inside the cell. Organelles can attach themselves to a microtubule. The microtubule then will take it from one part of a cell to another part. Right? So again, think of that as motility, inside the cell motility. Microvilli, we said, increases the surface area for absorption. All right, so let's look at some things now that are inside the cell, and this slide shows it very nicely. Right? Cytoplasm consists of what? Cytosol, which is the fluid part, and organelle. So I like this slide. I don't know how that other one got all messed up. All right, so cytoplasm is a jelly-like matrix inside the cell made of the fluid part and organelles. And we're looking at what the job of all these organelles is. The cytoskeleton, made up of microtubules and microfilaments, and we can see these microtubules and microfilaments. Here is a cell, and it's been stained with a stain that fluoresces. Right, it binds to microtubules and microfilaments so that you can see this network, this vast network inside the cell. And these are attached to proteins on the membrane, so it determines the cell shape, positions these organelles inside the cell, can even move organelles around or chromosomes around during mitosis. That's the job of these microtubules. Okay, organelles. Here I see a bunch of organelles once again. They have a different shape. So what would that tell you? They got a different function, right? Okay, we just talked about these mitochondria. Let's look at some of these different shapes that we're talking about. Okay, these spherical objects right here, these are vesicles. And vesicles can have different functions. And let's talk about some of their functions. If it is a lysosome, so a lysosome is this spherical vesicle, and if it's a lysosome, it contains digestive enzymes. For instance, lysozyme. And anything that gets inside this lysosome will be broken down by what kind of reaction? What breaks down? Hydrolysis. That's right. So lysozyme can break large molecules down into smaller ones via hydrolysis reaction. So a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. Like that monocyte that we looked at a little bit earlier, we saw engulfing a bacteria. When that bacteria is engulfed by a vesicle, that vesicle will fuse with a lysosome, and then the lysosome will break that bacteria down so that it doesn't become infectious under most circumstances. All right, so lysosome is one. Peroxisome is another kind of vesicle, and it's filled with an enzyme called peroxidase. Peroxisome, peroxidase. And if you ever hear that term, a word with an A-S-E on the end of it, that is nomenclature that it is an enzyme. It speeds up the rate of some kind of chemical reaction, right? And so peroxidase is a compound that breaks down harmful chemicals that are built up in our body because there's oxygen present. All right, so it can detoxify. So a peroxisome is important for detoxification. What about the lysosome? In one word, what's the function of a lysosome? Digestion. Yeah, you could say digestion or lysis or hydrolysis or whatever. If you say hydrolysis, I'll know exactly what you're talking about. Another kind of vesicle will be an endosome, E-N-D-O, endosome. And I think I presented this to you once before. An endosome is a reservoir of proteins that have a function on the cell membrane, but they're taken off the cell membrane, put into a membrane of a vesicle, and then they can't perform their function on the cell membrane. All right, the reverse of that is true. If all of a sudden the cell wants the function of these proteins, maybe it's a transporter. That's a protein. Right? If the cell wants to transport a bunch of molecules, it doesn't have to build all of those transporters from building blocks. It can just insert the endosome into the membrane. All those proteins then are now in the cell membrane, and they can go about doing their job, maybe for glucose transport. All right, so an endosome is for storing protein, membrane protein components, and it helps direct where they go. So maybe routing would be a good thing to put down. It routes where these proteins are placed, either in storage in an endosome or actively working in the plasma membrane. Okay. So those are some vesicles inside the cell. I can't tell these vesicles by their shape. The difference between the vesicles, you might be able to tell by their color, but probably not. I think all these vesicles have the same color. Is that true? Pretty much?
Yeah.
Mostly? Okay. Oh, well. Here I see an invagination of the cell membrane, right? And you can tell that if we bring this end of this plasma membrane together, this is going to form a vesicle. That would be an example of endocytosis, so this could be a vesicle with some particle in there. This also could be the end result of a secretory pathway. And a secretory pathway is when the cell makes a product and it puts it in this vesicle. The vesicle moves over to the cell membrane, fuses with the cell membrane, so that whatever was inside the vesicle now is on the outside of the cell. Right, so that's a way of moving things outside of the cell. Could be a hormone, for instance, or other kinds of materials. Could be mucus, for instance. Okay, and so some of these vesicles that we talked about stay inside the cell. Other vesicles will bring things in. Other vesicles will export material to the extracellular space. All right, so lysosomes, digestion, peroxisomes, detoxification, mitochondria. All right, so look at your cell, and this might be an exam figure as well. All right, and we said mitochondria are responsible for making ATP for us, and we need a lot of ATP. And I can't remember if I gave you a feeling for how much ATP we need, right? Like if we cut off blood supply or oxygen supply to our brain, how many seconds of consciousness do we have? Yeah, about 2 to 3 seconds. Good. All right, so I did mention that. So it's the job of this mitochondria here to provide that ATP from the other energy sources that we have in our diet, like glucose, for instance. All right, so a mitochondria has two membranes. Here's an inner membrane. Sometimes we call that the Christi membrane. And then here is the outer membrane. And there's a space between these two membranes that we call the intermembrane space. Inside the Christi, right, there's another space. We call that the matrix. When we get into the next chapter of cellular respiration, we're going to be really interested in these different spaces and membranes within the mitochondria. So it's good you could become a little bit familiar with the mitochondria at this point, right? So know the outer membrane. What's the name of the inner one? Christi, yeah, and then makes all these folds. And then you have a space between the membranes and then a space inside the Christi, and that's called the matrix. All right, what's interesting about this bacteria is if you look at it casually, it looks like a bacteria. It has about the same shape as a bacterium. And if you're really particular and look at it, right, you'll see that it has a chromosome, right, which is genetic material. So here is some kind of organelle inside your body that has a cell membrane around it. It has cytoplasm, and it has genetic material. What did we define that to be?
A cell.
A cell, right? A living cell, right? So we recognize that this right here at one time was something very much like a bacteria that infected cells that looked very much like ours but did not have mitochondria in them but had a nucleus, right? And these two cells learned to live together. They became a symbiosis. So that means that the host cell got something important from the mitochondria, but the mitochondria also got something important from the host cell. All right, so it's easy to tell what the host cell got from a mitochondria. What does the host cell get from mitochondria? ATP, readily usable form of energy. Right? Now, what does this mitochondria get from living inside our host cells? A place to live that's protected, for instance, because we have a very sophisticated immune system. There are many viruses that can attack bacteria, right? But our immune system will thwart those attacks. So protection is one good thing, right? But in order for this mitochondria to do its job, like making ATP, what else does it need? Yeah, it needs supplies, like glucose, like oxygen. Right, and so our body supplies all of these necessary ingredients, including protection. So the mitochondria gets something out of the deal, and then over time, these two cell lines, after living together over the eons, have evolved together so that this mitochondria can't live by itself, and our cells cannot live without mitochondria because they're dependent on that readily source of ATP energy. So that's what we call the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. And when we say theory, what do we mean? Yeah, pretty much everybody in the world believes that to be true, but also can show that, right, that mitochondria have a cell membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material, which is the definition of life, right? So it's something that you can count on. All right, when I say believe, right, that's more in the realm of religion. Theory is more in the realm of science, right? So we can prove all those things that we talked about. So it's not just a hypothesis. Okay, that's mitochondria. Ribosome. Here's a ribosome. We see that there's a tunnel through this ribosome. It's made up of two subunits that can come together, and this tunnel forms between them. What does a ribosome look like on that cell right here? Do I see some? They're really tiny particles. Like here is a ribosome. Right, here's a ribosome. Here is a membrane system with ribosomes on them. And a ribosome, if we want to think about it really nice and simple, which is how I like to think about things, is that's the workbench for making a protein. That's the workbench for protein synthesis. Right? And it is RNA, and as a matter of fact, since it is RNA, you could tell me the building blocks of a ribosome. What is it made of? It's made out of nucleotides, but what kind of nucleotide? It's just a regular old ribonucleotide, not a deoxyribonucleotide. That's what makes DNA, okay? And there's four kinds of ribonucleotides that our cells use, and they have to obey those base pairing rules. Can anybody remember the four kinds of bases that are used for RNA? There is adenine. Okay, I hear... Okay, guanine. I like guanine. Let's do guanine first. Guanine, what base pairs with guanine? Cytosine. Okay, then we have adenine, which is our third one. Adenine will always base pair with uracil in RNA, right? So we got AU, GC. Those are the four kinds of nucleotides and the base pair rule. So I see some ribosomes floating around in the cytosol. I also see some ribosomes attached to this membrane system that we call endoplasmic reticulum. All right, and since that's the workbench of protein synthesis, you could tell me now the function of this endoplasmic reticulum, and since it has like a sandpaper effect because all the ribosomes are attached to it, we call that rough ER. You should now be able to tell me what the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is. It is protein synthesis, right? Protein synthesis, but a special kind. What about these ribosomes in the cytosol? What's their function? Protein synthesis, exactly the same, right? It's a workbench. All right, but the fates of those proteins, where they're made, is going to be different. If a protein is made in a free ribosome in the cytosol, those proteins now float around in the cytosol, never end up outside the cell or inside a vesicle. Right? So they freely float around, do whatever job they're supposed to do. If it's a protein made by rough endoplasmic reticulum, it is produced, right, as that protein is being made. It ends up inside these what we call cisternae of the endoplasmic reticulum that's separated from the cytosol. Now, those proteins will either end up inside of a vesicle or they will end up outside the cell. They're never going to float around in the cytosol anyplace, right? So the fate is different of these proteins depends on where they're made. Okay, so that's the job of this thing, right? It's for protein synthesis. And indeed, now I can see some rough endoplasmic reticulum right here, so job for rough ER is protein synthesis. Here's the illustration. Here's a nice electron micrograph where we can actually see the ribosomes attached to the endoplasmic reticulum. There's another kind of endoplasmic reticulum that I see down over here, and you see that it does not have ribosomes. So can it make a protein?
No.
Indeed it cannot. Well, why is it there? If it can't make a protein, why on earth do we have this thing there? It makes other stuff, like lipids, for instance, right? Maybe phospholipids. Maybe you can take a lipid and maybe modify it somehow, making it a phospholipid, right? So it's important for steroid synthesis, right? And you could just say lipid synthesis. And there's something important that is not on the slide that eventually we're going to talk about, right? Has to do with calcium. And let's go back to this one over here. So here is inside the cell, cytosol inside the cell. Here is the extracellular fluid outside the cell. What can you tell me about calcium on either side of this membrane? Okay, what about outside? Is it high or low or the same as the inside? It's a lot higher. And inside the cell, when the cell is at rest, it is really close to zero. Okay, so there's a huge concentration gradient. But there can be calcium inside the cell, right, but not in the cytosol. It's going to be placed in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So calcium, so smooth endoplasmic reticulum is also a reservoir for calcium ions. So that's going to be hugely important for us a little bit later on in the class. So if the cell is going to use calcium as a signal to change its physiology, that signal can come from outside, right, the extracellular space, or it can come from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, okay, and it can flood the cell because there's a really, really high concentration.
So,
yeah.
So the smooth ER also has a function to make the calcium.
Store calcium, not in the form of a bone, but in solution. Right, bones are a storage place for calcium. If our body needs calcium, it can go to a bone and take calcium out of our bones. We don't like that when it happens, but it does. So bones are a reservoir. Another easier place to find calcium is the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So in a sense, you could think of it as a bone, not because it supports the cell, but because it holds calcium for other kinds of purposes. All right. So since we're talking about calcium really quick, where do we need calcium? What are some important reasons why we have calcium in our body? Oh, muscle contraction. Okay, that's good. Maybe pick that up from anatomy or something, if we talked about that in anatomy. Muscle contraction. What else is the calcium important for?
Making bones
strong, right? Making bones strong. Anything else? Okay, we'll talk about some other things, but we can just consider those two processes. All right, as we get older, we run out of calcium in our body, unless we're really careful with our diet and exercise and vitamins and things like that. So your body has to make a choice where that calcium goes. Does it go into bones to make bones strong, or does it go into muscle to make muscle contract? If you had to make a choice, what would you choose?
Muscle.
Yeah, muscle contraction. You can't even breathe without muscle contraction. Your heart can't beat without calcium, right? And so as we get older, our bones are sacrificed so these other important functions can take place. It's just unfortunate that it happens that way. All right, so that's part of the reason why people, as we get older, we can suffer from what kind of pathology? Osteoporosis, yeah, when bones are demineralized, and they get weaker when that happens. Okay, here's a pretty cool slide. It shows some rough endoplasmic reticulum, and it's right next to this other complex of membranes, and this is what we call the Golgi body. And the Golgi bodies, you see, are receiving vesicles that pinch off from the rough endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so this vesicle that binds to this Golgi body right here introduces what into the cisternae or into these spaces of the Golgi body? What is it getting from this rough endoplasmic reticulum? Yeah, proteins, right? And these proteins are behind this membrane. The job of this Golgi body is twofold. It modifies that protein. Maybe it chops it down a little bit, increases its activity, shortens that protein. Or maybe it adds a lipid molecule to it or a sugar molecule, but anyway, we're going to call that modification, right? And that it packages it into another vesicle. It pinches off that modified protein into another vesicle that moves into the cytosol. And once it's in the cytosol, the cell has to decide what to do with it. It might keep it inside the cell, and that protein might be, for instance, like a peroxidase or a lysosome. And that vesicle, those proteins will stay inside the vesicle, but not wander around the cytosol. The other possible fate for these modified proteins is that that vesicle can move over to the cell membrane, fuse with the cell membrane, and now whatever was inside the vesicle is exocytosed from the cell. And so here is an example of that secretory pathway, right? Starting rough ER, Golgi, vesicle. That vesicle then is moved over to the plasma membrane and secreted. So that's a nice secretory pathway. That also illustrates, right, that proteins made by the rough ER either stay inside of a vesicle or are secreted to the outside of the cell. They never wander around in the cytosol, unlike proteins made by free ribosomes in the cytosol. All right, so if we're going to think about function of Golgi, I would say two things. What would you think the functions of Golgi is? Yeah, modification is great. And packaging. Yeah, modifying and packaging. I don't think it has it on this slide, but I like those two. Okay, here is the nucleus. It contains the genetic material that's passed on from generation to generation, and in us, that's DNA. And DNA is used to make chromosomes. It just so happens that humans have 46 chromosomes in the normal everyday cells in our body. And those chromosomes, or that DNA, is behind this membrane. As a matter of fact, you can see it's a double membrane system, kind of like a mitochondria in a sense. Right? It evolved a little bit differently. And so these chromosomes are made up of immensely long strings of DNA. And when that DNA is used to control the function of the cell or the structure of the cell, that DNA has to be strung out in very long filaments. And those very long filaments are easily broken. And when a filament breaks, when a DNA filament breaks, then that information that is carried by that chromosome is lost, and then the cell might die as a result of that. Right? So the nuclear membrane right here is just the wall of protection of all that important genetic material from things that are happening in the cytoplasm that might damage that information, right? And if that information is damaged, the cell cannot find that information anywhere else. It's lost, okay? And then the cell is going to die. All right, so the cell, this nuclear envelope protects the DNA. And it then chooses what kind of materials can enter or leave. That's part of the way that it protects the DNA. This dark area right here is the active part of the nucleus, called the nucleolus. This is where a special kind of RNA is being made, and that is ribosomal RNA. That would be a good way to think of that. Ribosomal RNA, but the nucleolus is just the active form. You don't see any chromosomes in here because the DNA, that genetic material, is all in a very long filamentous form. Really, really long fibers, but even smaller than microscopically thin. So how long are these DNA filaments? Well, if we were to take the DNA from all the cells in our body and string all the chromosomes out from end to end, right, does anybody have a ballpark understanding of about how long that would be if we were to string the chromosome molecules from end to end? Not just in one cell, but in all the cells in our body. Okay, it would be 250,000 miles, which is the distance between Earth and the Moon. All right, so that gives you a sense of how long that filament is, and you can't see it with your naked eye, you can't see it with a microscope even, right? It's super thin, so that kind of gives you an impression of how fragile that molecule is, right? Okay, so that's protected by this nuclear envelope. And you can see some pores in the nuclear envelope, so certain materials can move across. On the outer part of the envelope, we see ribosomes, so protein synthesis can take place on the nuclear envelope, at least on the exterior side.
Question.
Yes.
So for the nuclear, the nucleus, they make the DNA and the ribosome. But for the nucleolus
right here. Nucleolus, yes.
Yeah. They make the ribosome and RNA.
Yes, a ribosome is made of RNA. The particular kind is ribosomal RNA. And we're going to talk about that just a little bit later in this chapter. So the nucleolus can make parts for a ribosome out of ribosomal RNA. So a ribosome is made up of RNA, not DNA. Okay? So I need to complete that thought. It will take maybe today or even next time to kind of give you an understanding of how that happens. Okay? Okay. Okay, gene expression. So we're going to start talking about that stuff right now. Thanks for asking that question. Beautiful. Okay. Here I have a slide. It's not in your book. This is what we call the central dogma of biology. And it is shows you, it's a flow diagram of information, how information flows inside our cells. And when there's a dogma, you should look this word up, dogma. Dogma is just a bit of information. It's a belief that you should just take for granted, never challenge, right, and just assume that it's true. Well, is that a good way to approach science?
No.
That's the exact opposite, all right? But I want to start right here, all right, and just tell you that this is something that you should believe in. We're going to have to modify this a little bit as we go through the class, okay? And we're going to look at protein synthesis in particular. So here is the central dogma of protein synthesis. Well, and we're looking at information. So information in DNA, it's contained in DNA, moves into RNA, and then that information moves into a protein. Okay. And so how many step process is this?
Three.
Okay. I see three entities right here, but how many steps are there that can interconvert these three entities? How many arrows do you see?
Two.
I only see two. So I think of it as a two-step process, okay? First step is converting information in DNA into RNA. The second step is converting information in RNA into a protein. All right, what else can you tell me about these arrows? Is it a one-way street or two-way street?
One-way.
It's a one-way street, right? Information only flows from DNA to RNA to a protein. All right, so the DNA inside of our nucleus directs the synthesis of certain proteins that belong to our body, right? Not any other organism, just whatever is encoded in this DNA. And personally, I like that a lot, right? It would be bad if proteins would direct the synthesis of DNA, could change the blueprint on how to make our cells, right? Because I'd be really worried about that, because if I were to have a chicken dinner, I would have to worry about waking up in the morning with feathers or a beak. Right? If those proteins could change who I was. Right? So information doesn't flow backwards like that. It only flows from left to right. Right? So that's what this says right here. Never in the reverse. DNA directs the production of proteins. Proteins does not change our DNA. And remember that DNA, that genetic material inside the cell, is the blueprint on how to build our cells. And how they're built changes over time. And if the nucleus or this DNA determines the shape of everything inside our cells and even the shape of the cells, what is it determining as well?
The
function. That's right. So the nucleus or this DNA not only controls the structure of everything, but it controls the function of a cell because it's determined by the shape of all these different compounds. All right, so it's a two-step process. First one is transcription. Second one is translation. Transcription is the conversion of information from DNA to RNA. And where do you always find DNA? In the nucleus. So where does transcription always take place? It's got to be in the nucleus, because that's the only place where you have DNA that is in an active form. It's protected behind the nuclear envelope. There might be times in the cell life cycle where DNA is not behind the nuclear envelope because it disappears, but if it is, then it's wound up very tight and protected in the form of a chromosome, right? For instance, during mitosis. But it can't be used to make a protein when it's in the form of a chromosome. All right, so why do we call this transcription? What's the building block of DNA? That's a nucleotide, and in particular, deoxyribonucleotide. What's the building block of RNA? That's a ribonucleotide, right? So nucleotide, nucleotide, and the difference is really minuscule to me, but small changes in shape can mean a big difference in the function of these molecules. But basically, I think of the building blocks of DNA and RNA as almost being exactly the same, right? So the language of DNA and RNA is the same because the building block is the same, right, with a little modification here and there. All right, so RNA is really a copy, an exact copy of the information in DNA. The nucleotides are used in both cases. So what does transcription mean? Well, if you apply for a job, say that again.
Copy.
That's a copy. What kind of copy?
Exactly.
It's like a photocopy, right? It's an exact copy, but I mean it's a photocopy. So if you're applying for a job, going to another school, somebody might want to know what kind of classes you took, right? When you took them, and what kind of grades you got when you took them, how many times you took a class, you know, all that kind of stuff is in admissions and records. And you have to provide your employer, your new employer, with a
transcript.
And what is that transcript? It is a photocopy. It's an exact copy, right? The information doesn't change. I wish I could change my transcript, but it can't, right? It is, the information is exactly the same. Same letters, nothing has changed. Okay, and that, so this step transcription, think of it as a photocopy. RNA is a photocopy of the information, okay, of DNA. Ha ha ha. Okay. Well, why is that? Well, this RNA is going to move into the cytoplasm, into the cytosol. And this RNA can be damaged. There are a lot of things that can damage that RNA. The information is lost. But is the cell going to die? No, because that information is still held in reserve inside the nucleus. Right? If that information is needed once again, the cell can go back and transcribe that information to make more RNA. So that's the beauty of transcription. It keeps DNA safe. It makes working copies of DNA that can go into the cytoplasm and do its job. All right, so what is a gene? A gene is a sequence of these nucleotides. That's a chemical set of instructions for making a specific kind of protein. Now, sometimes this is a little bit lost on me. When we say sequence, what do we mean by sequence? What's the sequence of, what's the sequence of a word, let's think of a word, let's say difficult. When we say the sequence of letters in the word difficult. It's just the order of letters. So what is that? It is D, help me out, I, F, difficult. Okay? So if you know the sequence, right, of that word, of these letters, right, you can make that word, and then that word has a special meaning. We all agree what the meaning is. And if we change the sequence of those letters, what are we changing? We're changing the word, right? And we're changing the structure of that word, the function of that word changes as well, the meaning of that word changes, right? So when we say sequence of nucleotides, right, we're just talking about what nucleotides are right next to each other, and what? Do you see a branch pattern, or is it all nice and linear? It's just linear, right? And what are the nucleotides in DNA? As what? Go ahead, tell me the base pair rule too.
GC,
AT, right? So the sequence of these things would be like what? G, C, A, T, 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 A, C. Okay, so now I know the sequence of these nucleotides. That's going to have a certain meaning. We're going to see how that becomes meaning inside the cell a little bit later on. Okay, so transcription, making a photocopy. The language of DNA and RNA is the same, right? Just like your records and administration and records and the transcript maybe that you have in your pocket, exactly the same. And where does that take place? Always in the nucleus, because that's where DNA is. It's protected. Translation, the second step, where we take information in RNA and make a protein out of it. All right, what's the building block of RNA? Yeah, it's a nucleotide, right? Ribonucleotide. What's the building block of protein? Amino acid. You guys knew all this stuff already before taking the class. All right, so the language is different. RNA is a nucleotide language. Protein is an amino acid language. What do you call that process when you take information in one language and convert it into another language? That's translation, right? So, I don't know, Farsi to Hindi, Mandarin to English, right? That is translation. Now, what about the information? Those languages are totally different. But what about the information in one language compared to another? Exactly the same, right? Exactly the same. Okay. Now, where does this take place? This takes place in the cytoplasm, not inside the nucleus, because that RNA leaves the nucleus into the cytoplasm, and in the cytoplasm you find the workbench, which is the ribosome, right? Ribosomes are in the cytoplasm, so translation takes place in the cytoplasm. All right, so how many step process is protein synthesis? Two, transcription, translation. Hopefully if you think about those two words right here, it will make really nice, easy, perfect sense for what it means. If not, look up these definitions in the dictionary. All right, so translation occurs in cytoplasm, never in nucleoplasm. It's the linear sequence of nucleotides in messenger RNA determines the linear sequence of amino acids in a protein, which makes up a protein. Okay, so we're just thinking about just long chains of molecules, repeating units over and over and over again. What do we call a long chain of molecules, which is a repeat of just similar units over and over and over again, like glucose, 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 glucose? I like to think of it as a polymer, right? And how would you make a polymer from building blocks? Dehydration synthesis reaction, exactly right. Okay. Okay, so a gene. Let's talk about a gene. We find genes in DNA. These are just lengths of DNA, which means that it is just a whole bunch of nucleotides all put together in a nice long chain, right? And it codes for the synthesis of RNA, right? So if it codes for the synthesis in RNA, what is that step called, DNA to RNA? That is transcription, right? So a gene is just a set of information, one set of information that's necessary to make one particular RNA molecule. Right, but not just randomly, it's going to have the same sequence of nucleotides. And one of these kinds of RNA is what we call messenger RNA. This carries information on how to make a protein into the cytoplasm. Right? It's transported out of the nucleus to ribosomes. What's a ribosome once again? It is workbench. Think of it as a workbench of where translation takes place. All right, but a ribosome can't make a protein unless it gets information on how to put amino acids together. It needs to get that information of the sequence of amino acids, and that's what the messenger RNA is for. It determines the sequence of amino acids that make up a protein, and that protein is made on a ribosome. All right, and when we say sequence, do you have a sequence in mind? D next to I, next to F, right? And that word difficult. That's what we mean by sequence. And in terms of DNA, it could be GCATTT, like I have right here. Okay. What about G? U? A? C? C? G? What kind of genetic material is this? RNA, because I don't see any T's in there, and indeed I see uracil. Okay. All right, so the base pair rules are just a little bit different for RNA. All right, we talked about this. Gene expression takes place in two stages, transcription, translation. You know the building blocks, where that takes place. We talked about a nucleolus already. That's a place actively making RNA. Here are a couple definitions. There's something called a genome. A genome is the complete set of genes that are contained in our 46 chromosomes. Right, so there are many genes, and the gene can determine how to make a particular protein. Right, and so a genome is made up of nucleic acids, for instance. And those nucleic acids then determine the proteins that can be made inside your body. If we consider all the proteins that can be made inside your body, we call that the proteome. All right, so we've got genome, the genes, their product are proteins. If we consider all the proteins, we call that the proteome. Okay, let's look at some genetic material, in particular DNA. Here is a chromosome. You can see this underneath a light microscope. It's extremely long filaments of DNA, like what we just mentioned, but we can see it because these long filaments are wrapped around certain kinds of proteins, and then it's wrapped, and then there's more wraps, there's super wraps, and even more wraps on top of that. So then these long strands of DNA, which I see way over here, we call this extended chromatin, is condensed, wrapped up, into a chromosome. When this extended chromatin is condensed into a form of a chromosome, it is protected, relatively protected form. If it is in this long filamentous form, it's easily damaged, right? Because it's super long and very, very thin. So when a cell is using the information of these, the sequence of nucleotides in DNA, it has to be unpackaged from proteins that protect it. And these proteins are what we call histones. And if we wrap some DNA around a histone, we call that a nucleosome. And then the nucleosomes are bunched together, packaged together, right? And then even these packages of nucleosomes together are coiled some more, even with some more proteins. And eventually this thing gets a lot shorter and all packaged together. When DNA is in this package of a chromosome, it cannot be used to make a protein, only when it's in this form. Only when it's in an extended form. Now, what can you tell me about extended chromatin? Is it brittle? Is it robust? It's brittle. It can be broken. Remember, when it breaks, the cell is going to die. Right? Here is in a nice protected form. So when I see a chromosome, I think of a suitcase. And I have a big smile on my face because I'm going someplace. Right? All right, so what am I thinking? I'm thinking I may want to go to Denpasar and do some surfing or something. So what am I going to take? I'm going to take my swimming suit, going to take some suntan oil, right, sunblock, my sunglasses, toothbrush, swimsuit, right, what else? What else am I going to take? A towel, maybe some cutoffs in case I want to go out to a nice restaurant or something, right, instead of my swim trunks. So I'm going to have all of this stuff. Am I going to walk onto an airplane with all of this stuff in my hands and under my arms? No. Because what could happen? Yeah, you could drop something. You could lose it, right? You could leave your sunglasses someplace. Okay. So all that stuff underneath my arms I think of as extended chromatin. Okay. It can be easily damaged. But if I have my sunglasses in my hand and not in my suitcase, what can I do with those sunglasses? I can use it. But if those sunglasses are nice, safe, so I can't lose them, in my luggage, can I use my sunglasses? No, they're nice and safe, but I can't use them, right? So I think of a chromosome of all my good stuff that I don't want to use, right? But I'm not going to lose it. If it's in an extended form, I'm carrying it around, I can use it, but it's easily lost and damaged, right? So extended versus condensed chromatin. Okay, so I see something about DNA right here, which I think we should probably look at just a little bit. How many strands is DNA made up of? It is a double-stranded molecule, right? So I see one strand here, right across the other side. I need another strand, right? The bases of those nucleotides point to the interior of the double strand, right? And you can see that there are different colors and different shapes over here. And if you look at these colors and shapes, you're going to see that there are four different kinds, right? And they have to obey specific base pair rules like GCAT. All right, that makes up DNA. Okay. Euchromatin is the part of the chromatin that can be active in transcription. right, is lighter in color. Heterochromatin is a highly condensed part of the chromosome, and it can be permanently inactivated. So it might not ever be able to be used again in a person's life, right, at least in that particular cell, and it's darker in color. Euchromatin, okay, can be either condensed into a chromosome or extended, right? If it's heterochromatin, it can never be extended and used. That's the way I think of these two terms right here. All right, so euchromatin is something that can be used for transcription. All right, so if we need extended chromatin to make a protein, right, then these coils have to be uncoiled, and one control mechanism for uncoiling all these chromatin from these histone molecules is by a process of acetylation. Acetate is just a two-carbon molecule. When it's joined to these histone molecules, they just have a tendency to unwind. Right, so here I see some chromatin. It is extending, and here it's even extended a little bit further. That exposes this region of DNA to other kinds of things inside the cell. Transcription can take place when it's nice and extended like that. Transcription cannot take place when the chromatin is all wound up on these histone molecules. All right, if we want to inactivate this gene, right, we can take that acetyl group off and then the chromatin coils back up on the histone molecules, right? So that becomes deactivated. So acetylation and deacetylation is one way to turn genes on and off. A nice control mechanism. And what do these genes control? What do these genes make for us?
Proteins,
yeah. This is where that information on how to make a protein comes from, right? And if it's a deacetylated portion of the chromosome, then your body cannot make that protein because it's hidden. It's all wound up on these histone molecules. All right, so one gene for sure codes for one polypeptide chain, right? And each gene is several thousand nucleotide pairs long. And how that happens, okay, RNA synthetase needs a special enzyme. Here is an example of that special enzyme. I know this is an enzyme because you see an ASE on the end of this term, right? And so here is a polymerase. What does a polymerase do? It makes a polymer from building blocks. And this is not any old kind of polymerase. It's an RNA polymerase, which means what are the building blocks for RNA polymerase? It is the ribonucleotides, right? And so it can make a polymer or big long string of these ribonucleotides put together. Okay. And that RNA polymerase works off of a DNA molecule. DNA works like a template to make an RNA molecule. Right, there is a start sign on a gene, and there's also a stop signal. And in order to get at that information, I guess, where is it? Sorry about flipping so much. Okay. These base pairs in the double helix can't be read by anything. Right? The DNA molecule has to be unzipped, right, so that these two strands separate from each other, and then the sequence of these bases is exposed to other kinds of enzymes that are inside the nucleus. So how hard is it to break this top strand from the bottom strand, to break these bonds between these complementary bases right here? Yeah, that's what I wanted you to see, right? They're hydrogen bonds. So you can zip and unzip this double helix very easily because they're held together with very weak bonds, namely hydrogen bonds, which is one of the reasons why we talk about hydrogen bonds. All right, and the DNA polymerase can do that. In order for DNA polymerase to bind to the DNA molecule, it can only bind in a certain location that we call a promoter region. And the promoter region has to have a specific kind of molecule binding to it to allow for transcription to take place. And we call that a transcription factor. So a transcription factor has to bind to a promoter region along with this RNA polymerase in order to make an RNA molecule. Without a transcription factor, then RNA polymerase cannot transcribe that gene, even though it is in extended chromatin. It just can't do that. So these transcription factors act as little control signals for transcription. Let's look in particular at RNA synthesis. So on the top, I see a double-stranded molecule. And I see something else that tells me what kind of molecule, what kind of nucleic acid it is. What kind of nucleic acid is on the top? Yeah, as DNA, right? Because it is double-stranded, number one. And number two, I see thymines, right? So I know this is DNA. Down over here, I see, well, what else do you see? You see the base pair rules, right? AT, GC, right? So that's something else that I know that this is DNA. Here I see that double helix unzipping, right? And we said that's easy to do because, yeah, because these hydrogen bonds between these different base pairs, right? DNA polymerase is going to bind to just one of the strands of DNA, not both. It only attaches to one, so there's one that's called a sense strand, then there's one that's called a nonsense strand. We're not going to talk about what the function of the nonsense strand is, but the sense strand over here is worked on by RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase makes a long polymer of ribonucleic acids, otherwise known as RNA. Right? And RNA polymerase knows what ribonucleotide to join to the next one because it uses DNA as a template to do that, according to base pair rules. Right? The only difference is that every time there's an adenine in DNA, the RNA polymerase puts a uracil. Every time there's a cytosine in DNA, RNA polymerase puts a? Yeah, guanine, just like in DNA, right? The only difference is U is substituted for thymine. All right, so RNA polymerase moves down the DNA molecule, making this RNA through that process we call transcription, right? And so this, what's the sequence of this RNA molecule from here to here? I just want to make sure that you have a sense of what sequence means. What's the sequence? Okay. Yeah, we'll do this. Oh, you guys are good. You did it really fast. It's what? C, U, A. What's this right here? C, G, U. That's the sequence. At least without my reading glasses. That's what it looks like to me. Okay? That's the sequence of nucleotides in this RNA molecule. And you can see that the DNA was used as a template to make this RNA molecule. So if this RNA molecule gets damaged when it gets into the cytoplasm, it can be made again because where do we find DNA? Nucleus. Protected in the nucleus, right? So it can go back and make another copy. So I have a way of thinking about DNA. I think of it as all that material in the reserve section of the library. Okay? You can check it out, but you can never take it out of the library because we don't ever want it to get damaged, lost, or whatever, right? And you can make a photocopy in the reserve section, take it out, and if you lose that photocopy, no big deal. You can always go back to the reserve section of the library and make another photocopy. All right, this process stops when the RNA polymerase runs into a stop sign. Where it started was a promoter region. What had to bind to this promoter region besides RNA polymerase in order for it to start transcribing? A transcription factor, right, transcription factor, yeah.
So, real quickly, the polymerase not only binds, but it also breaks the hydrogen bonding, or no?
Yeah, there's a unziperase and an unwinderase, okay. We call a helicase, and I'm just a little confused whether it is for DNA synthesis or RNA synthesis. Okay, I think DNA synthesis is a little bit more specific in terms of other enzymes that it needs to unwind and unzip the DNA molecule. So there are different enzymes for those things. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that RNA polymerase is going to make a long RNA molecule. What are the kinds of RNA molecules? Here they are. All right, ribosomal RNA makes ribosomes, right? And what is the function of a ribosome? Workbench for protein synthesis out in the cytoplasm, out in the cytosol. And what do we call that? Protein synthesis out in the cytosol, that is? Translation, going from nucleotide language to amino acid language. Okay? Okay. All right, so there's also something called messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is the information on the sequence of what amino acids have to be put next to each other to make a particular kind of protein, right? So So if we change the sequence of letters in a word, we change that word. If we change the sequence of amino acids that make up a protein, we change what the function of the protein is. Right? And that messenger RNA tells us what that sequence of amino acids is to make that particular protein, the one that your body wants. This messenger RNA comes from something called pre-messenger RNA. Right? Pre-messenger RNA can be maybe chopped in half or altered somehow to become the more active form, right, that's used to make a protein translation, right, in the cytoplasm. The last thing we have right here is transfer RNA. So this RNA, the ribosomal or the ribosome, needs information from the dictionary how to spell out a protein that's in the messenger RNA. But what else does a ribosome need besides the knowledge on how to build the protein? It needs the letters to make that word, right? It needs the amino acids in order to make a protein. And it's the job of this transfer RNA to bring all the various kinds of amino acids over to a ribosome so that they can be put together in just the right way, right, to make a protein. And the right way is determined by the sequence of nucleotides in messenger RNA. Sometimes we just say messenger RNA is the message. It's just the correct spelling for that particular protein in terms of amino acids. All right, so here we have a double-stranded molecule. We know that to be DNA. It's got to unwind. RNA polymerase has to work on that, right, through the process of transcription. So here is the result of one gene. So we only needed one promoter region, one transcription factor. RNA polymerase went all the way down the line and made this complicated molecule. And you can see how many colors is this complicated RNA molecule made of? Wow, three. I was hoping there would be two. I see one color here and one here. And then there's one here and one here and one here. Okay, let's say there's two. Can you see the two I'm looking at? Okay, I see two dark ones here and here. And then I see three light ones. Light, light, light. Okay. Okay. So, one gene can make this messenger RNA, and it can have different segments. Right, and here it's just signified by different colors. And these different colors will have different names. They can be exons or introns. And let's just say that the darker color is an intron, lighter color is an exon. The exons are the part of this messenger RNA that is used to make a protein. And it has to be cut away from the introns in order for it to work. So here is a messenger RNA from one gene, and this one gene could make more than one protein, right? It could make, maybe if we put all these exons together, right, it makes one protein. If it puts just the two end ones together, that's a different protein. Or if it just uses the end one, that's another. Or just the middle one, that's another protein. Or the end one on the other side, that's another kind of protein. So numerous kinds of proteins can be produced from just one gene, depending on how the pre-messenger RNA is cut and spliced back together. And that's all controlled by things inside the cell. Right? And we call that alternative splicing. Alternative splicing. These different kinds of exons can be put together in different kinds of ways depending on what kind of protein the cell needs. All right, so what was the genome once again? What's a genome? More than just just more than DNA, a little bit different than RNA. It is just all the genes that are in our chromosome, all the genes that are in DNA, see, that are controlled by transcription factors, RNA polymerase needs to bind to. Right? So there are less than 25,000 genes in our chromosomes, or 46 chromosomes. Yet, those 25,000 genes can produce over 100,000 different kinds of proteins. So that was confounding. That was very confusing to people sometimes, right? Because we always said that one gene produces one protein. But that didn't happen. All right, so then we realized that a product from one gene, namely a pre-messenger RNA, can be cut and spliced together in different ways to make different sets of instructions to make different proteins. We call that alternative splicing. So what do we invoke to explain why only 25,000 genes can make over 100,000 different kinds of proteins? What would we use? Very short language. Alternative splicing. Yeah, but you got to have a sense of what that means, right? got to know about introns, exons, and different enzymes that put those things together. Okay. Protein synthesis. Here I see a ribosome, and then here is a protein that's being made. All these little dots right here, let's just call each one of these little nodes an amino acid. All right, so here I maybe see two amino acids, here I see four, right here I see more amino acids. So as we look from left to right, what can you tell me about that protein that's being produced? It's being made longer and longer and longer, right, because their amino acids are being joined to it. So these ribosomes can actually move down the messenger RNA. So here's this little thin filament right here is the messenger RNA. It determines where a different amino acid is placed in this growing chain. So if a cell needs lots of copies of this protein, lots of these different ribosomes can attach to it. This is what we call a polysome. Right? So on a polysome, you need a nice electron micrograph in order to see these things. Okay. Now, how many nucleotides make up an RNA molecule? How many nucleotides make up an RNA molecule? How many nucleotides are there in RNA? Sorry. Yeah, there's four. You know the base pair rules, right? G, C, A, U, for instance. All right. So there's only four nucleotides. And does anybody know how many amino acids, common amino acids, there are?
20.
Yeah, there's about 20 common amino acids. So how is it that only four nucleotides can determine which one of 20 different kinds of amino acids are put together in the right sequence? Right, if there were only four amino acids, then it would make sense, right? Every time there was a G, you would put one amino acid. When there's a C, you'd put a different one, right? But there's 20 different kinds of amino acids. And the way that biology, our biology has figured that out is that there has to be at least three nucleotides to determine what one amino acid is put into that sequence of amino acids that make up a protein. One can't do it, right? If there is just a one-to-one correspondence, then there could only be four amino acids, but there are many more than that. So we call that the triplet code, right? So there has to be a sequence of three nucleotides in RNA to determine what amino acid is placed in that growing chain of amino acids that we call a protein. And this thing right here, it's probably the most amazing figure in your textbook. It looks a little dry, maybe right at the moment. This is what we call, right, and you've got to, and it's not labeled really well, okay, on this slide, but you should label this the universal genetic code. Universal genetic code. It's a code because it says that in a protein that's growing, if we should put a cysteine amino acid in this location, right, then the proper sequence of DNA has to be ACA. There's no way we could figure this out empirically. It just has to be measured. So anytime there is a sequence of ACA in DNA, that's going to call for the placement of a cysteine in that location. Right, so that's what we call the genetic code, universal genetic code, because all life forms use basically the same genetic code. Right, it doesn't change. That's why we say it is universal. And that can be used as evidence to support what kind of theory? Evolution, right? Just on this molecular level. Since all life forms use this to make proteins, right, this decoding, right, that is nice evidence of evolution. Does it prove evolution? Absolutely not. But it's very good evidence, right? That's just one form of evidence. Okay. So we're going to use this chart to actually make some proteins if we know what the DNA sequence is or the RNA sequence, right? We're going to actually go from one to the other to the other to the other. You do not need to know this, okay? But you want to know, going from AGG to UCC, what that is called. AGG to UCC, what's that called? That is transcription. And UCC to serine is called? Translation. Cool. Translation. Okay, so DNA to RNA, transcription. RNA to amino acid, translation. I was so busy talking to students, I didn't have time to print one out. So there is none to answer your question. No sign-in sheet today.